where it's difficult to pin down a specific price per transaction on a specific day? Is that what we're arguing about over these back taxes?
I would say that anytime you have an area where a lot there's a great deal of subjectivity and uncertainty, you're going to have disputes, and when there's disputes over a resource as valuable as oil, I think you can see why we might end up with $1 billion assessments and that sort of thing. The problem, of course, is that I couldn't speak directly to any particular taxes or assessments. But as a general point, yes, I think you've correctly assessed the situation and the disputes over value, but also disputes over any cost items as well. Are behind the $1 billion assessment.
Okay, well, I'm going to get off this right now, but I disagree that it's that very much subjectivity comes into this, because it seems to me that there are recorded transactions every time that oil is sold or exchanged or traded in any way, and that it is possible to determine what the value received for both sides is. And I'm surprised that that should be called a subjective thing. It's probably a heck of a
When I said subjective, I meant subject to interpretation, not subjective in the sense that it's ephemeral or ethereal or doesn't exist. There are obviously disputes between taxpayers and tax collectors all the time, and it's not just limited to Alaska and their resource.
Okay, one other question, Chuck, if you wants to mention this. I recall reading some time ago that the composition of the crude stream in the pipeline would be changing over time, and that by now a higher percentage of NGLs is in the pipeline than was, say, 5 years ago. Perhaps next year it will be higher. What I also recall from my own experience is that NGLs bring a higher market price than does crude oil. So does it not stand the test of logic then that if in fact we have a higher percentage of NGLs being transported through the pipeline and being sold in a market for whatever it's being sold for, petrochemicals or something else, that is increasing the value of the barrel, and therefore we ought to be recognizing that in terms of the wellhead value. But yet it seems to me that our wellhead value is being called a barrel of crude oil, and the price is structured on the value of a barrel of crude oil as opposed to maybe 40 gallons of crude and 2 gallons of NGL or some mixture. Would you comment on that?
Well, I guess the easy way to comment on it would be to suggest that, in fact, that's what markets are for, and that, in fact, buyers and sellers both recognize just exactly what product it is that they're negotiating for, and that, in fact, the price that the two parties agree on will reflect the value of the components. In the case of North Slope crude, your point is well taken. There will be additional NGLs put into the line, particularly when they begin stripping a lot of the liquids from the gas. It sounds like it could be something potential, but I think you should understand the baseload of crude oil coming through the pipeline is still large enough that the average API gravity will probably not change all that much. Although, as you point out, those particular chemicals now will be in the barrel, so potentially there may be somebody out there in the market who would be willing to pay a little extra to get them. But I guess I'd go back to the economist's sort of cop-out and say that actually the market will determine the value of the oil, and in fact, given the statute, insofar as how companies are required to report their price, the market price should be reflected in our severance tax and royalties.
Okay, to just say this a different way, what I'm concerned about is that the first transaction, the first sale transaction in the market is from a producer to a refinery, and they're being sold a barrel of oil. The refiner takes it into his plant and separates the oil from the NGL. The NGL brings a higher price in the downstream marketing activities than the oil does, yet the state's receiving none of that benefit. I'm concerned that that we ought to be looking at the fact that maybe the pipeline is really carrying two distinct products with two distinct prices.
Well, of course, it all depends on who the oil is being sold to. I mean, we do sell, the producers on the slope do sell to a lot of different refiners, and a lot of them refine the oil themselves. It would be, what you suggest, I think, would be fairly difficult to achieve. I mean, it would be nice if we could sell it to a homogeneous refinery where the state would require that you pay a different amount for each of the products that you produced, or say if we were able to tax gasoline or something sold in California, but unfortunately, our powers don't go that far. So, let the market decide, I guess, is sort of the test you eventually come back to.
I'd like a break here in the next 15 minutes. And I do have several questions here that I wanted to ask. The committee does plan on meeting again at 1 o'clock, and I'd like to maybe get some of those questions out of the way so some of the people may not want or have to return this afternoon. But I guess one question to Esther, and I'm not sure to address just who to address it to, and that would be the latter part of last session, we talked a lot about the economic limit factor and how it kicks in on these lower values, or does it kick in on the lower values of oil. And also there's some ongoing discussions with Conoco, and I was wondering if you or someone in your department would like to talk about what's the status on those discussions.
I think Revenue can respond on the economic limit factor better than I. I have not met with representatives from Conoco since the legislative session. I understand the problem that they have, but also understand my own limitations, as you may know, and certainly as the Conoco representatives know. We had made an offer before it was addressed by the legislature to at least postpone upfront royalties. Although the
ultimate...
Okay, I beg your pardon. I should have been in the microphone. I'll just repeat for the benefit of people listening in that the ELF factor is something that Revenue should address rather than myself. With respect to Conoco, I've not met with them personally recently, but I understand that they have been in touch with our Division of Water and Gas. Before the legislature addressed the problem that they have with respect to royalty, we had made an offer to spread royalty due from those leases over time so that the upfront cost would not be as great to them, recognizing the problems that they had. They were not able to accept that offer. I'm still willing to make a similar offer, but I don't feel that I have the authority to respond to their request to reduce royalty without ultimately getting a full return to the city.
Well, you mentioned, Esther, in your comments about Chevron wishing to have a reduction in the value open the bids, reopen the negotiations on the price. Is there any other discussions with any of the other purchasers of
I'm not aware that any other royalty oil contract purchasers have approached us with respect to the price reopeners, but it may be that they've not come due yet. I mean, that the time has not expired for them to be able to approach us with respect to price reopeners. But those are specific terms in those royalty oil contracts to reopen price, but it's also very clear that to reopen price at a lesser amount would require legislative approval. And where we are with Chevron is that they would want to reopen the price terms closer to the beginning of the legislative session, so that if we were to negotiate a lower price than what they are now paying, that that it would be sent to the legislature for approval.
So you don't anticipate any others that, well, not at least at this time, you know?
None before me now. But the two should not be equated. The Conoco situation and the Chevron situation are two different.
I understand that. I don't know if Pet Revenue wants to talk anything about the, let's address the L factor and how it might affect collection of taxes. I know that that's something that's going to be addressed in several weeks in the committee specifically for that, but if you want to make any comments on that at this time, that's something for Pet Revenue. Please go right ahead.
Well, this is Chuck Logston, and I guess I can address that. I'm not sure exactly what you had in mind as far as comments on the economic limit factor, except to say that there are a couple of things in the statute. For one, we know that there will be a lowering of Prudhoe Bay's effective tax rate due to the expiration of the 10-year production horizon, which is specified in whether or not the ELF is applied when the calculated value is greater than 0.7. The other is that with the low wellhead prices that we realized in June and more than likely July, there is a chance that the price of oil will be so low that producers on the North Slope would be encouraged to file for a hearing and a redetermination of the ELF based on actual production data and price data. And of course, there is a possibility, if they would apply, obviously, I think the evidence would probably be in their favor if they did apply. That's suggestive that the ELF would be, as a result, lowered, so that potentially the severance tax rates could be lowered on some fields in the North Slope. I think it's safe to say those are issues that are going to have to be dealt with, and I really don't have any formal presentation prepared on any of those issues at this time, other than what was presented to the legislature last April and May.
Well, I guess my question, and perhaps you answered it, Chuck, is if there's been any ongoing discussions with the department regarding the, as they say, the kicking in of the L factor due to the lower oil prices. Say they haven't made any formal application at this time.
I'm probably not the person to address this. I don't know that this is in my area of expertise. I'd be more comfortable if Mr. Monkman maybe could address that question.
Richard, are you still online?
The time for requesting a hearing on the economic limit factor for the fields on the North Slope won't be until the end of this calendar year. That is, there cannot be a request or a recalculation of the economic limit factor until December and January of this upcoming winter. Now, obviously, the problem with the ELF, as Chuck has alluded to, is that if you have a zero wellhead value, for example, the economic limit factor will also be zero or extremely close to it. You multiply the economic limit factor against the severance tax floor of 80 cents a barrel, and at zero ELF, you'll get a zero severance tax liability. So if, say, in the upcoming winter, the economic limit factor were calculated to be about zero, we would not be able to look forward to any severance tax revenues for the upcoming year, which would have a disastrous effect on our budget, obviously. Now, the companies would have to come forward and request a hearing. They would also have to prove by clear and convincing evidence what the economic limit factor should be. Given the volatile price situation, we certainly couldn't make any predictions at this point as to what would happen. But at a zero wellhead value, the potential exists for no severance taxes, the way the statute is written now.
Okay, thank you, Richard. Is there any other questions from the members of the committee? Representative Szymanski has a quick question.
Sure, quick.
I was kind of curious. I haven't focused on the Conoco situation since we got out of session. But your what's your understanding of what Conoco's proposal is today with Commissioner, in discussion with your staff?
I don't have a specific proposal.
I mean, have they made a proposal to the staff of oil and gas?
I don't think so.
And
there was and has been always a general request to us to reduce royalty at Milling Point to 12.5%, even though the company had agreed to a higher royalty at the time that unit agreement was entered into. But I have nothing more specific than that before me.
Thank you.
Mr. This is maybe along the same line some of the other discussions we've taken, and that's regarding our net profit share leases. Now, have you evaluated the net profit share and in light of these new economic times we have?
Well, the only net profit share leases that I'm aware of that are being produced now are three leases in the Kapari unit, and I think that's still too early to truly evaluate those leases. But if you're asking in general terms whether we're looking at future sales, not using net profit share leases, we always have under review the terms of our sales. But those leases that have already been entered into for either a certain royalty or for a net profit share are binding agreements, and we're not looking at going back to undo or to modify existing contracts or existing leases.
I guess what I was referring to is I believe you have a sale coming up. It's an 87, isn't that correct? You have a sale in 87, but I guess my question is, number one is just an evaluation of what is the return, or what looks like the return on those net profit sale, and then what's your future plans for oil and gas leasing, and you know, what kind of structure do you anticipate having those sold at?
Well, we always have net profit share as an option in leases, and in times when the companies have smaller amounts of upfront money, net profit share leases may commend themselves even more than in other times, because what you do is the state shares the risk with that operator in terms of exploration costs and upfront costs, and only benefits when and if there is a discovery and production, and benefits, of course, a share of the net profits. So in actuality, a net profit share lease in tough times might be beneficial to companies who are struggling hard with cash flow problems to have upfront costs, to meet upfront costs.
So it seems like if the company's profits is all in transmission of it and not in the oil itself, then it wouldn't be to the state's advantage to have a net profit share.
Certainly all of those are factors to consider, and as I say, the only three leases that I'm aware of that are being produced that are net profit share leases are three leases in the Kaparik unit, and I think it's too soon yet to really have a good evaluation of the kinds of items I'm sure you have in mind that might be a factor there as to whether they're, it does give a good return to the state.
The only topic I think that we didn't address fully this morning, and it was included in your packet, was storage. And storage, although you did mention some of the problems with the storage, I believe Roger Marks was going to talk about perhaps some storage alternatives. And I don't know if the other members of the committee feel the same way that I do, but I would. Roger, if you do have some time this afternoon, maybe we could talk a little bit about that. And also, there's
as I mentioned earlier today, that there will be a discussion on ANWR, our presentation by the DNR, but I just received a note that they can't get here until 3 o'clock. So what I'd like to do is convene again at 1 o'clock. We'll talk about the storage, and if there is any public testimony, some people would like to make some comments, we'll take it at that time, and then we'll recess until 3 o'clock.
Mr. Monkman, a question.
I believe Marco has one question, Mr. Monkman. And the only reason I'm convening again at 3 o'clock as opposed to putting it off, because I know Representative Cotton will times be back at 1, so we'll take it right at 1 o'clock. Is that okay with you, Roger?
Mr. Monkman, you mentioned that the way things look now, that we will not be collecting any severance taxes for the next fiscal year. And I wonder if that's the way the budget projections that that the administration is working off of right now, if that's plugged into that.
Well, I may have misspoke. I certainly hope we will get some severance tax revenue next year. If there is a well-ahead value of zero, for example, for the rest of this calendar year, and the producers were able to prove that in a hearing before the Department of Revenue, then there is a chance. But we're all crossing our fingers and knocking on wood and hoping that the OPEC temporary price agreement holds and that we won't be faced with that situation.
Thank you. Me too.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
This is the moderator in Homer. Representative Maru had to step out temporarily, but he did have a question on what the abbreviation NGL stands for.
Natural gas liquids.
Thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank Esther and members of your committee, and also people from Department of Revenue and Chad and everyone else that has participated online for a very informative morning. Thank you very much, and we'll see some of you this afternoon.
Oh, I think we're going to do it. Let's talk to Davis here.
Can we get some things started, Davis?
Yeah.
You surprised?
Yeah, I just heard negative sorts of things about
those.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Gary.
Who's online?
June.
Who's on first? What's on second?
June on hold.
Okay, we'll go ahead and reconvene the Oil and Gas Committee meeting this afternoon. We were going to have some comments from Roger Marks. I have to apologize to the public that took us long to convene, but I suggested the wrong place to be. Roger, would you like to come up? Okay. Yeah, Roger, you were going to... there was some material in the packet regarding storage and some of the different possibilities, I suppose. And you want to make some opening remarks?
I haven't prepared any oral comments. Discussion is in the back, but maybe I can maybe summarize that discussion.
That'd be fine.
Okay. In terms of introduction, to reiterate some major points made this morning, the state... was the royalty owner of the biggest field in North America, and the volume controlled of that royalty oil makes it competitive with any independent producer in Lower 48 in terms of volume controlled. Total royalty oil is about 220,000 barrels a day. By September, the in-kind oil will be about 120,000 barrels a day. Along with that, right now, the wellhead price of oil up at Pump Station 1 is about as low as it can go. But the West Coast, Gulf Coast sales, the wellhead price is coming in at about slightly over a dollar now. And added to that, this is the last of the peak year for Prudhoe Bay. Current prices are so low in absolute terms now that it's highly probable they will eventually recover to some extent. Given OPEC's recent announcements, this may be in the near future, but I would add hypothetically to that, don't hold your breath. If we are in a world of vacillating prices, the state could optimize its ultimate revenue by storing its in-value oil until price recovers, or in periods of low price, until price recovers after those periods. To reiterate some comment made by Commissioner Wynicke this morning, this would not be riskless. The ultimate feasibility of this depends on the timing and magnitude of price recovery. Legal issues aside, to place storing of oil in context with underlifting, we sort of did an economic analysis of the alternatives to underlifting along with underlifting. The best place to store oil is in the ground from an economic perspective. You'll underlift now in exchange for production later on. With underlifting, a state can store virtually all the oil it wants to, it can avoid the permitting and logistical complexities of the other storage facilities, and the only cost to the state would be the opportunity cost of the foregone revenue. At a 10% discount rate, which is what the permanent fund earns now approximately, this would amount to 9 cents a barrel for a 6-month period of underlifting, 19 cents over a year, and 39 cents over 2 years. And that is also the necessary price recovery to break even. There would be a cash flow loss of $220,000 a day in royalty income at current prices, which would be made up when production occurred.
What's that compared to a year?
Pardon?
$220,000 times, I'm sure you've done that, times.
Matter of fact, I haven't. $222,000 a day is what the at current prices, weighted average wellhead price times the times some barrels. If underlifting is not possible, the state could take the in-value royalty oil in kind and store it somewhere. Eventually, there would be an in-kind sale similar to the one last year. In general, the state would need to get the producer 6 months' notice for denomination, which denominating from in-value, in-kind back to in-value. And this might be considered the minimum time frame for initiating a storage program. If we did this, the state would take possession of the oil pump station one, which represents a radical departure from customary state policy. Traditionally, the state has explicitly unburdened itself from oil at pump station one. This passivity has limited any downstream benefits in exchange for administrative simplicity. Although some benefits have accrued through in-kind sales, it may be necessary for the state to be more aggressive in pursuing downstream benefits, of which the storage option is one. I might add parenthetically here, too, that the producers would be less prone to store oil or curtail production since they earn profits on the pipeline shipping and refining. And they earn these profits with the state's in-value oil as well as their own. And subsequently, we could expect to see production even at negative wellhead values. We have developed three alternatives for storing oil in addition to the preferable underlift option. Note, however, that the volume at hand is so large that it would tax existing storage capabilities and the state may only be able to store a portion of the available oil. Might add, too, before we go into these options, that a considerable amount of research went into this, so the numbers are ballpark, but there would not be the gospel. And they could change over time too, as market conditions change. The first option we looked at would be bringing in tankers to Valdez and storing oil on tankers.
Can I ask you a question on this storage of tankers? And I think Commissioner Wynicke mentioned it. And that's that the state would have to pay the upfront tariff charges on that.
That's correct. But, I mean, the trade-off there is that's really a cash flow problem and not really a cost problem, because if we did that, we received sort of a Valdez price for the oil rather than a pump station one price. So we would receive the pump station one price plus the tariff at the point of time we sell the oil. So it's a cash flow problem.
Right.
Okay, currently, with the depressed oil market, there is a lot of excess tankers in the world, and a tanker could be obtained fairly cheaply to store oil. It's a practice that's done all over the world, done quite frequently in Asia and done in Norway. The largest tanker that can enter Valdez can hold about 1.9 million barrels, And given 120,000 barrels a day of in-value oil, that could hold about a half month of royalty production. And through convenience exchanges with other producers, the tankers would only have to be filled once. They wouldn't have to go in every day, you know, line up every day and get their fill. There are numerous deep protected fiords adjacent to Valdez where a tanker could stay. And each tanker would require a pretty large mooring buoy to keep it in place. We've contacted shipbrokers, and a foreign bottom tanker could be charged for about $10,000 a day, which amounts to about 16 cents per barrel per month, which includes the crew, bunkers, and heating. And the transfer fee to transfer the crude from, say, the pipeline to the tanker would be 15 cents per barrel one time. And then the buoy would cost about $2 million. If it turns out that we need an American bottom tank, and I think a discussion here explains why we may or why we may not, it would cost about half again as much, about $15,000 a day for the American bottom tank. And insurance would be about 1 cent per barrel per month to insure the cargo. And then the discussion here talks about regulations. The second option would be to build tankage in Valdez to store oil. We talked to the people in Valdez. The city itself owns 135 acres adjacent to the eastern side of the oil terminal. About 40 acres of that is being cleared and used for pipe storage as a rock base and could be leased for about $5,000 an acre. Leasing of the land would be just fractions of a cent per barrel. A 510,000 barrel storage tank would cover about 2 acres and cost about $4.20 per barrel with minimum operating costs, and would take about a year to build. The advantage of this option over the tanker option is that it has a one-time cost with cheaper long-term per barrel rates, and the state would always have access to it. It's also environmentally less risky than having a tanker offshore with oil. And it would assist Valdez in its economic development.
That would be, that would store 2 days of royalty oil, basically.
Approximately. Let's see, 510,000 barrels is about, that's about how big the tank, about the, what the size of the tanks are now, which is about as big as you want to build for engineering reasons.
You're saying each tank or the?
Each tank holds 510,000 barrels, so divide that by 20,000, it would be about 25 days of 120,000 barrels a day in value production.
In terms of the
tank. Okay. Yeah. The disadvantages to this option is that it would be slower to implement. It's more expensive for short-term storage. I looked at trade-off between the tankers and the tanks. It's about 18 months. And it would be necessary to initially determine how long storage would be necessary. The third option we looked at, this turns out to be economically the best option, would be storage in lower 48 tanks. The independent storage industry in lower 48 is small and fragmented. Most major producers and refiners stock oil in their own tanks, so there's very little need to simply accumulate oil over a long time. Most storage is for the short term for downstream passage. If they have oil, they do not need. Most parties have the luxury of simply not producing it. Nevertheless, about 10% of the total domestic storage capacity is in private hands. This amounts to about 40 million barrels, about 25% of which is currently idle, and more could be made available with sufficient notice. Storage costs at such a facility would be about 15 cents per barrel per month. This includes pumping in, out of the tank, and insurance. The advantage of this option is that it is a replica of existing practices and would be quicker to implement, and the disadvantage is that the state would have to arrange transportation. In summary, these three options in underlifting are systematically compared in the attached summary table. For cash flow purposes, we have also included the necessary appropriations to finance each option. Except for the cost portion, which is shown as a light item itself, these appropriations are not cost, but transfer payments in time, and will be recovered upon sale of the oil. For example, in option 3, the state would initially pay the tax tariff and shipping, but receive a market rather than a wellhead price. And might add, too, that the appropriation amount shown on that table is pretty much overwhelmed by the TAPS tariff, which is the big bulk of the appropriations that would be needed. And the cost item shown on that table is also the necessary price recovery to break even. If you want to turn to that table, kind of maybe go over the highlights of it, we've looked at the three options in underlifting, comparing the costs for a 6 month, 1 year, and 2 year time period. The important item to look at is, you know, the total cost, because as I mentioned, the appropriation is shown for cash flow purposes. Even though obviously it is a problem, a lot of those appropriations are made up upon sale of the oil. One thing the table shows is that the underlift option economically, you know, far surpasses the other options in terms of its feasibility. And the next best option, as mentioned before, is the storage in Lower 48. I'd be happy to answer any questions now.
Well, I have a question first.
Mr. Chairman?
Excuse me, I have a question which is related to option three, and that's perhaps, it has to do with the federal government's storage of oil. I read recently that they've increased the amount of oil that they're going to be storing from 500 million barrels or whatever. I could have these figures off by magnitude to 750 million barrels, or maybe that's gross figures off. But even is that related at all to these storage Lower 48 tanks? And that's, I know that's underground storage, so it is.
The Department of Energy controls the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. We contacted them and say, hey, could we, you know, store some oil in your, they store in salt domes in the southeast. They said, no, we can't. But they are looking to increase their storage capability now. I think it's about 400 million barrels now they have stored.
So I figured the magnitude were correct. And I believe they were going to increase that to 700.
But I'm not sure. I think they are increasing. I'm not sure how much.
Okay.
But they have told us that they don't. We couldn't store oil there with them.
Okay.
Who said that?
The Department of Energy.
Who?
A person I talked to was seems to know what's going on with the Strategic Petroleum Reserve.
Well, can I suggest that maybe we ask the congressional delegation to petition the Department of Energy and try to get an answer at a much higher level? It seems we'd have something that the Secretary of the Department and maybe even the Office of Management and Budget of the White House ought to be interested in, because I'm sure they want to charge us a few pennies for storage, and it's in the national budget's interest as well as our own. And I think that needs to be addressed at a much higher level than it has.
Worth a shot.
Yeah.
I believe I heard Andre Rue, Representative Rue, did you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I did. This witness, the information that this witness has is of great interest to me. I just wondered whether it's in the information packet, the original information packet. By the way, I do have such a packet coming from the LIO in Soldotna. They informed me that it was 26 pages long, so I told them to mail it. But is this information in that packet?
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Representative Rue, if you have a question, go right ahead.
Well, I didn't have a question on specifically what the witness is talking about. I do have an interest in perhaps if the witness has any opinions on the feasibility from his point of view on what was decided against by DNR recently, and that is having a refinery in Valdez with presumably the owner of the refinery shipping finished products out in his own tankers to the west, to the Far East.
I would defer to DNR's analysis of that issue.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Pinalgary?
Well, Roger, I don't want to put you on the spot, and I really appreciate the information you put together. It's very helpful. Can you just tell me, we're not to hold you to it, what do you think we ought to do?
I'll just point out some facts. If you look on this table here, that cost item where you see total is the amount of recovery we need to break even under each of these.
You're looking at the one-time appropriation?
So where it says total with the footnote 3 on it.
Yeah, right.
That's basically the amount of recovery any of these options need to break even. That's what I think we ought to do. I think, you know, just saying facts again, it's a great deal. State controls a great volume of oil that's going down the pipeline right now. We're getting very little return for it.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Any other questions from
some reason I haven't been focusing on this area for the last couple months, but what I'm kind of curious about, is there anything that statutorily would have to be done to implement any one of the provisions other than appropriations?
To my knowledge, none at all.
So you could implement underlift or any of the other options if you had appropriation?
Right. Now, it's my, I believe, anything, so I believe the way it works in terms of volume, if we want to denominate all that in value oil to in kind so we could store it, we have to go 6 months to do that. But if we're going to do that longer than a year, it needs legislative approval. But if we were to do it for 364 days, it would not. I had some kind of preliminary discussions with the Attorney General's office, and that's, I think, the gist of what they told me.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. I guess I misunderstood something that the Commissioner Monica had mentioned earlier about the limits that the state might come up against as far as our option for underlift. Do you think the statutes right now would allow as much of an underlift as we could negotiate with the producers?
Well, underlift.
That's one of the options. Or you're just talking about options 1, 2, and 3 that you weren't talking about.
No, I was talking about underlift included.
Yeah, so I thought you were.
No, underlift. I thought you meant changing all this in kind, in value oil in kind. Mm-hmm. As far as underlift, just to summarize what was said this morning, that the way the royalty contracts are written, we can't really mandate an underlift, but we could basically negotiate with the producers for one.
That's right. I'll just get that straight. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Roger. Is there any other questions? Chuck, did you want to give us the latest OPEC report?
Okay.
Chuck, I just want to make a comment. Remember that guy that was in the legislature with us about 2 years ago that said we ought to have, didn't you need his legislation to have an OPEC representative from Alaska?
We tried to encourage logs to attend the meetings. I think his travel budget got cut.
Oh, I think we already got one. We did this near past state legislation on it.
Anyway.
Push the button up. Yeah.
Okay, it's on. Chuck Logson here again, and I guess the biggest news that we've gotten from the world of oil is that OPEC is going to apparently agree to cut their production to 16.5 million barrels a day, roughly speaking. Ones who would have to reduce their production, the largest in terms of barrels. The agreement that they signed really says they're going to cut almost 2 million barrels a day from their current production. And that's really what makes, practically speaking, what makes the thing work. Although, when you add up all the other OPEC members, everyone is going to be taking somewhat of a cut from their current level, and on a percentage basis, the total production, some of them will be taking it as higher percentage than Saudi Arabia. But the other issue is, other than just whether or not OPEC is going to actually cut their production, is not yet. The other issue is, well, what about Iraq? And Iran has said that they have other ways of controlling Iraq's production, which suggests that we may be seeing another outburst of
violence in that long-standing war, and of course, with that situation, who knows what's going on? Maybe that's, there is speculation that Iran cut a deal with Saudi Arabia, which suggests that maybe the Saudis wouldn't be unhappy if Iraq's Saddam Hussein fell. I don't know. There's all kinds of wild speculation in terms of the oil and oil politics in the Middle East. I guess the bottom line is that revenue will be putting together new estimates of what our petroleum production and other revenues will be in September. Now, OPEC is scheduled to meet, I guess it is about the end of September. The accords start the 1st of September. It looks like we may be in somewhat of the uncomfortable position of putting together our new estimates once again at about the same time that OPEC is trying to decide whether they can get their act together. I guess at this stage, I would be cautiously optimistic that we may be able to get, if not fiscal 87 revenues, we may see fiscal 88 revenues drift back upwards towards those numbers that were used in preparing the budget last March. Unfortunately, oil prices have been low long enough that we're going to see a big shortfall in fiscal 87, probably whatever happens with respect to OPEC getting it together. But I should say that this recent agreement is the kind of good news that we've been waiting to hear for some time, and I think most analysts, every time they've met, I've kind of had personal feeling that there's been about a 50-50 chance that they would get their act together, and it looks like now they've gotten their act together, now the next question is, what's the likelihood that they'll stick with it? And I think it's better than 50%, so that's a personal opinion, but we do have some good news. Unfortunately, just, I don't want to stress this too much, but I think you should realize that we're talking good news that oil prices are going to stabilize at $15 a barrel. That still represents nearly, we were getting $18 a barrel at the wellhead last December, so it still represents a dramatic drop in world oil prices, and consequently, we'll still be looking at a big, big shortfall compared to the booming years.
Chuck, I read in the paper where I think it was Saudi's oil minister took a verbal crack at Prime Minister Thatcher because of the high rate of production from the North Sea. I'm just wondering if you keep track of what's being written all over the world. Has there ever been, have any of the OPEC members ever said anything about Alaska production? Do they pay any attention to what we do at all? Do they care how much we produce? How do they view us?
Yes, they do. As a matter of fact, I think from what I've been able to discern, and with the few OPEC people that I have come in contact with, they're well aware of Alaska. Alaska tends to get lumped in with the other high-cost producing areas like the North Sea. And I think on the other hand, OPEC looks at Alaska as being part of the U.S., and they're well aware of the prohibition against export and some of the other things that might make Alaskan oil a player in the world market rather than sort of influencing oil prices only indirectly through, as a major domestic producer. But yeah, they're aware of Alaska for sure. They're aware of Alaskan gas as well.
Chuck, what's the world production of oil now?
On a daily basis, I guess the key number we look at is the OPEC production, and it has been as high as some estimates as 20 million barrels a day, opposed to a nominal guess on the need from OPEC of about 17.5, which, you know, that's often been pointed to as the overhang, or that's the amount of the glut, that's the amount of excess production which was driving prices down. On a world basis, I'm not really sure. I think what they call the free world production is probably somewhere around 48 or 49 million barrels, something like that, maybe a little less.
I guess the point I was trying to make is that even if OPEC does cut back production, are they still going to be able to drive the price of oil? I mean, they may
players, but are they going to be able to lead the price of oil by cutting production?
I think that if they can hold to the level that they have agreed upon, that there will be a price effect. That should represent a shortfall. That should represent less oil than what the market would call for at the current price, which means the price would go up and the market would clear. So I think the answer to your question sort of lies in what kind of cooperation can OPEC expect from other producers in the world. And I think the key non-OPEC countries who have discretionary production, except for North Sea oil and Great Britain in particular, they have indicated that they don't intend to produce a drop less. But I think most of the key non-OPEC producers like Egypt, Mexico, and even Norway would probably voluntarily, if not cut their production, at least not increase it to take advantage of any price increases that might occur. The reason I think that is because most of those countries, not only have they made formal policy statements, but it would be in their self-interest to do so, since the current situation benefits no one, as none of the world exporting regions in terms of oil income.
You mentioned earlier Iraq-Iran, Iraq-Iran war. They have some discretionary power, or discretionary oil, to increase it by several million barrels a day.
Right. To make this agreement, the current agreement really sort of, what made it work was Iran came in and said, well, let's set aside ourselves and Iraq for a moment, and let's zero in on everyone else in OPEC. Let's get everyone else in OPEC back to their 1984 quotas. We, as Iran, we will continue to produce 2.3 million a day, and we will see that Iraq doesn't produce more than the 1.8 that they're producing. That's what they've said. Now, when Iraq brings on an additional pipeline that's under construction right now, I think it's the one through Turkey or Syria. But anyway, they will have another pipeline on, which would theoretically raise their production ability up over 2 million a day. So that's kind of another one of the ifs. I mean, what does Iran mean when they say that they have ways, and what do they intend to do? And that's probably the biggest question mark insofar as an actual violation of the current agreement, that because Iraq didn't sign anything, as far as I know.
Well, thank you, Chuck, for giving us an update on that.
Okay.
There's nothing else on the agenda until 3 o'clock, but if there is someone that would like to, from the general public or from one of our companies that does business in the state, would like to make a statement or testimony, that's certainly afford them the opportunity now. If there isn't anyone that would like to testify, then I'll recess the meeting until 3 o'clock.
Mr. Brandon wants to.
Jim, do you have anything you want to say?
No.
Well, thank you. Thank you all for coming and for the presentation. We'll recess till 3 o'clock.
So we will be closing up for the day. The afternoon session has been canceled.
Yeah, he's here at town meeting.